both had our rifles, but Allie told me I'd have to be the one to shoot you. She couldn't bear the thought of doing it herself. We hid in the woods watching till we lost the daylight. Then there wasn't no point. Harper and her escorts came out of the firs and up alongside the soccer pitch, a snowy basket filled with moon glow. Harper couldn't tell if the thudding pain in her abdomen was a cramp of tension or the baby driving a heel into her. "Allie," Harper said, "I'm sorry I scared you. I shouldn't have put you through any of that. But you have to understand, I can't bear the thought of sending a kid into danger when it's something I can do myself. And you're a kid. All of you lookouts are kids."
"See, but you did put us in danger. You put the whole camp in danger," Jamie told her.
"I was careful. They wouldn't have found my tracks."
"They didn't need to find any tracks. They only needed to find you. Maybe you think you wouldn't have said nothing, but it's funny how a pool cue up the snatch will loosen someone's lips." "You shouldn't have gone. You knew you shouldn't have gone. And what tore Allie up the worst was knowing she shouldn't have let you. We made promises to keep people safe, to keep well-meaning dipshits like yourself in camp, under watch. All the lookouts promised Mother Carol."
"Mother who?"
"She's no one's mother, Jamie."
Harper thought Mother Carol and the lookout sounded like a band that might have been playing Lilith Fair in 1996.
"We promised her and we promised each other and we blew it. Carol was sick to death when she heard you were gone, like she hasn't been through enough already."
"Fine. You've said what you had to say. Tell Carol you delivered her message, and next time if I feel like a breath of fresh air, I'll be sure to try and drop her a note. And Allie, you can quit the silent treatment. I'm a little too old to be impressed by that one. Got something to say? Do me a favor and spit it out."
Allie turned her head and glared at Harper with wet, accusing eyes. Jamie snorted.
"What?" Harper asked.
"You think you're in trouble? Ain't nothing compared to the hill of shit Allie is under for letting you go. Allie is doing penance for it now. She asked for a chance to make amends and Mama's story gave it to her."
"How? Did she take a vow of silence?"
"Not exactly. You remember what Father Story used to do? That thing about sucking on a stone when he needed to think?"
Snow squealed underfoot as they climbed the hill. Harper needed to the count of three to figure it out. It had been a long night.
"You have to be shitting me." "I shit thee not."
Allie is carrying a stone in her mouth to think over her mistakes and refocus on her obligations.
"The last time we let down our guard, someone took a stone and used it to crush Father Story's head in. We all carry rocks now, to remember."
Jamie removed one hand from her pocket and showed Harper a stone as big as a golf ball.
"Oh, for Christ's sake. So how long are you going to walk around sucking on that thing, Allie?"
Harper asked her, as if there was any hope of an answer.
Allie looked like she wanted to spit the rock into Harper's face. "That all depends on you, see?" Jamie asked. "Now, you weren't at the meeting when we agreed there needed to be consequences for people who think they're above the rules. No one is too pissed at you. Mikey saw you row out to the Fireman's Island, so we've known you were safe for a while. Ben and Mother Story had a talk and agreed it wouldn't be fair to make a big deal out of you leaving safe territory. At the same time, Carol was worried the rest of the camp would get ugly if you were held to looser standards than everyone else. So they come to a decision, and Allie agreed. Allie only has to carry the stone in her mouth until you take it from her. And you only have to carry it in your mouth for..."
"Jamie, I appreciate you being so direct with me, but you need to know, no matter what you think you all decided, that I am not ever going to suck on a stone in some medieval act of penance. If you think I will, then Allie isn't the only one with rocks in her head." They emerged at the southeastern corner of the chapel, near the steps down into the women's dorm in the basement. Three lookouts sat on logs, singing a rustic and curiously brutal hymn, "They Hung Him on a Cross." Their eyes were bright as brass coins, and the dragon scale on their exposed hands was lit like burning lace, bathing the snow in crimson light. Their breath unspooled from their lips in threads of red steam. All of them were starved-looking, bones showing in their faces. Thin hands, thin necks, sunken temples, concentration camp haircuts. A random, disassociated notion occurred to Harper. When your stomach is empty, so is your head.
Well, I hope you change your mind, nurse, because Allie's contrition doesn't end until yours begins. Allie, Harper said, I take responsibility for my fuck-up. Full responsibility. Which means if you want to play martyr, that's up to you. I'm not making you do it. She cast a sidelong look at Jamie and added, And no one is making me do it, either. It's degrading and infantile. If someone wants me to peel potatoes or scrub pans, I'm not afraid to get my hands dirty. But I'm going to pass on this particular grotesque act of self-abasement, thank you. Allie is ready to do what it takes to make things right. People look up to you, nurse. Sure would be nice if you'd do the same. Allie is glad to serve as an example for however long it takes. Or until dinner. Nope, wrong on that. If you won't take the stone from her and carry it yourself, it stays in. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Although you might recall we lookouts gave up our lunch a while back so the likes of you could eat. I guess Allie'll have to take it out and put it under her pillow when she sleeps, but that's it. I don't know which of you is worse, her with her mouth full of stone or you with your mouth full of nonsense. Harper stopped walking, turned her back on Jamie Close, and spoke to Allie with her hands. Stop this, she said, in the language of silence that Nick had taught her. Allie met Harper's gaze with cold, hating eyes. She had only ever learned how to finger spell, and so her reply came in a slow trickle that Harper had to sound out in her mind. Y-O-U-K-N-O-W-H-O-W-T-O-M-A-K-E-M-E. The last part of the statement involved the use of Allie's middle finger, and was widely known even to people who hadn't studied sign language. Book 5. Prisoners. 1. From the diary of Harold Cross. June 30th. Back from the cabin. Shouldn't have had that third hot pocket. Am half sick from it, and even my smoky damn fart smell like pepperoni. Interesting news from Cordoba. 200 infected killed at the Jesuit monastery in Alta Gracia. Bodies bulldozed into a pit by the military. Dr. Ba was able to recover 4 corpses, including the body of El Horno de Caminar, who single-handedly held off the military's assault for most of an hour by creating some kind of flaming tornado, an act that allowed almost 1,000 people with dragon scale to escape into the jungle. Sound like anyone we know? Translated into English, El Horno de Caminar means the walking furnace. Dr. Ba had a chance to work on the recovered bodies and emailed me the preliminary findings. Interesting stuff. He autopsied the brain of a recently infected child, and it showed only a dusting of the spore in his sinuses and on the membrane sheath around the cerebral cortex. But the Argentinian fireman had been infected for much longer, and the Draco Incendia Trichophyton had penetrated deep into his superior temporal gyrus. El Horno de Caminar gave an interview to an alternative medicine blog in the early days of the plague and explained how he was able to control fire without ever being hurt by it. You can ask the spore to keep you safe, but you must forget your own voice first. You can ask it to fight for you, but you must come to it as a supplicant without language. Probably a crap translation, but it struck me as interesting. The superior temporal gyrus harbors Wernicke's area, one of the seats of speech. I feel he has explained everything, and yet I understand nothing. 2. Harper read the notebook in the bathroom, with the door locked, to prevent someone from walking in on her and finding her with it. She felt vaguely like an adolescent, privately examining a work of pornography with a dry mouth and a tripping heart. When she finally stepped back into the wardroom in the milky glow of dawn, she discovered a white rock on the foot of her cot, a sheet of paper under it. When will you take your medicine? Someone had written. Father Story drowsed in one bed, Nick in the other. With both of them asleep in the same pose and with the same frowning look of concentration on their faces, it was impossible not to see the close familial resemblance. The child was still inside Father Story somewhere, as a fly remains perfectly preserved in a bead of amber. The old man waited for Nick, a baggy overcoat that he would be ready to slip on in 6 decades. Harper glanced at the curtain into the waiting room to be sure she was unobserved and put the notebook back in the ceiling. Then she picked up the stone and ducked into the next room. Mindy Skilling, a pretty waifish girl of about 20, was on watch. Harper had treated her last month for a urinary tract infection. Mindy gave Harper a dewy, pitying look. She had a lovely, expressive face, bright eyes and long, curling lashes. And Harper remembered that in a former life, Mindy had studied acting. "Did you put this on my bed?" Harper held out the stone. Mindy shook her head. "Who did?" "Wouldn't you feel better," Mindy asked, "if you just got your punishment over with? I know Allie would feel better." Her eyes widened in sudden inspiration. She scooted to the edge of the couch. "What if you just put the rock in your mouth for 5 minutes? I tell everyone it was a whole half hour." "Not 5 seconds," Harper said. "Oh, and Mindy, next time you've got an infected bladder?" Mindy stared at her with apprehensive, ready-to-be-hurt eyes. "You can piss off," Harper said in her mind. But in real life, she only sighed and said, "Forget it," and slipped back into the ward. She really didn't have the right temperament for vicious comments. The few times in her life she had said truly nasty things to people, it had left her with a bad flavor in her mouth. A stone couldn't taste any worse. 3. Harper got it again, and she got it worse, the next evening, at first meal. There was already a line, wrapped halfway around the inside of the cafeteria, when she came in out of the dark, snow melting in her hair. She had half run from the infirmary, with a shrieking wind at her back the whole way. She couldn't feel her ears and was desperately hungry from the first whiff of maple syrup and oats. Half the camp was already seated, and the room was loud with conversation and spoons scraping in bowls. It was so loud, Harper didn't hear Gail Neighbors at first, didn't know someone was talking to her, until Jillian Neighbors poked her in the ribs to get her attention. The Neighbors twins were right behind her, side by side. They wore matching red turtlenecks, an unfortunate wardrobe choice that suggested a resemblance to Thing One and Thing Two from the Dr. Seuss book. "Allie didn't eat all day yesterday," Gail said. Harper was pretty sure it was Gail doing the talking. She was the one with the pointy chin. Harper turned her back on them. "If she doesn't want to eat, that's up to her. No one is making her starve." One of the sisters yanked on her sleeve, and Harper had to glance back. Jillian looked a lot less friendly than Gail. Her lips were a thin white line. She hadn't shaved her head recently, and her scalp was blue with 5 o'clock shadow. "Is it true it would only cost you half an hour with the stone to make amends?" Jillian asked. "That and my dignity." The two sisters did not reply. Harper turned her back on them once more. The line edged slowly forward. "You're a real stuck-up bitch," one of them said softly. This time, Harper did not glance back. "You know, some people think," said the other, and was shushed by the first. Harper did not care what some people thought, and did not dignify this comment with a response. She didn't know Allie was on mess duty, dishing out scoops of oatmeal, until she reached the counter. Allie still had the rock in her mouth. Harper could tell by the way she pursed her lips. Allie lifted her gaze and stared at Harper with watery, loathing eyes. Then she reached under the counter, found a smooth, egg-shaped lump of granite, put it in a bowl, and held it out to her. Harper set down her tray and walked away, the neighbor sisters shrieking with laughter. 4. Late at night, or early in the morning, depending on how you cared to look at it, Nick gave lessons in how to speak without words, and Harper was his attentive pupil in the lonely classroom of the infirmary. If anyone had asked why Nick was staying in the infirmary, instead of with his sister in the girls' dorm or with the men in the boys' dorm, Harper would have said she wanted to keep him under observation. She would have claimed she was worried about a late-developing inguinal hernia as a result of his appendectomy in the summer. The word inguinal would be frightening enough to shut down any further questions, but there were no questions, and Harper suspected that few people gave any thought at all to where Nick slept, When you had no voice, you had no identity. Most people took no more notice of the profoundly deaf than they did of their own shadows. They sat across from each other on Nick's cot, in their pajamas. Harper kept 3 buttons undone below her breast to show the ripe pink globe of her belly. And when they were finished practicing sign for the night, Nick popped the cap off a Sharpie and drew a smiley face on it. "What are you going to name her?" Nick asked. He tried to ask in sign language, but she lost the thread and he had to write it down. "A boy," she said with her hands. He pressed both palms on the bulging gourd of her stomach, closed his eyes, and inhaled gently. Then he signed, "Smells like a girl." "How girls smell?" she asked, her hands finding the words automatically, a fact that produced a small flush of pride. He gave her a confounded look and wrote, "Like sugar and spice and everything nice, duh." "You can't really smell if it's a girl," she wrote back. "People who have lost one sense," he scrawled, "become stronger in the others. Don't you know that? I smell lots of things other people don't."
"Like what?"
"Like there's still something wrong inside Father's story." Now his gaze was solemn and unblinking. "He smells sick. He smells too sweet, like flowers when they rot." Harper didn't like that. She had known a doctor in nursing school who claimed he could smell death, that the ruination of the body had a particular fragrance. He insisted you could smell it in someone's blood, a whiff of things spoiling. The moss-colored sheet between the ward and the waiting room twitched, and Renee Gilmanton ducked through, holding a bowl covered in tin foil. "Norma sent me over with a glop of oatmeal for the sick old kid," Renee said, crossing to Nick's bed and sinking down on the mattress, directly across from Harper. Renee mined one pocket of her parka and came up with something else wrapped in tin foil.
"I figured he wasn't the only little guy who might be in the mood for a snack,"
nodding at Harper's distended belly. Harper half expected to peel back the foil and find a rock inside.
"Eat that, bitch," Renee would tell her, "and then get on your knees and repent for Mother Carol."
But of course it wasn't a rock. She could tell even before she unwrapped it, just from the weight. Renee had brought her a biscuit with an improbable smear of honey in the middle.
"Allie ought to be ashamed," Renee went on, "giving you a rock instead of breakfast. You're well into your second trimester. You can't be skipping meals. I don't care what she thinks you did."
"I let her down. She trusted me not to do something stupid, and I screwed her."
"You were trying to get medical supplies to care for your patients. You were trying to collect them from your home. No one can forbid you to go home. No one can take your rights away from you."
"I don't know about that. The camp voted to put Ben and Carol in charge of things. That's democracy, not tyranny."
"My black ass. That wasn't any real election. They took a vote after an hour of singing and everyone was spaced out in the bright. Most of the camp was so blitzed they would have voted for a top hat and believed they were electing Abraham Lincoln."
"The rules..." Renee shook her head.
"This isn't about rules. Don't you know that? This is about control. You went home to get medical supplies, to help people, to help Carol's own father. Your real crime wasn't breaking a rule about leaving camp. Your real crime was deciding for yourself what would be best for the people in your care. Only Carol and Ben get to decide what's best for the people in Camp Wyndham now. Carol says we speak with one voice. What she doesn't say is that voice belongs to her. There's only one song to sing these days, Carol's song. And if you aren't in harmony, you can stick a stone in your mouth and shut the hell up."
Harper looked sidelong at Nick, who was bent to his bowl of oatmeal, paying them no mind, and for the moment showing no sign at all of the tummy ache that had brought him to the infirmary. "That would sound better if a cremation crew didn't turn up while I was home," Harper said. "If they had found me, they would have made me talk before they killed me. My husband was with them, my ex. He would have made me talk. I can see it in my head. I can picture him asking me questions in a very calm, reasonable voice while he uses a pair of garden shears to take off my fingers."
"Yeah, well, that part is... I don't know what to make of that part. I mean, what are the odds they'd show up at your house when you were there? That's like being struck by lightning."
Harper considered telling Renee about the Marlboro man and his secret broadcast, the radio station he claimed to hear in his thoughts, his psychic transmission from the future, then decided she didn't want to think about it. She ate her biscuit instead. In the honey, she tasted jasmine, molasses, and summer. Her stomach rumbled, a sound as loud as someone sliding furniture across the floor, and the two women traded looks of comic surprise. "I wish I could do something to tell Allie I'm sorry," Harper said.
"Did you try telling her you're sorry?"
"Yes,
but that's over and done. That should be enough. She's not herself, Harp. Allie and I never got along that well, but now she's like someone I don't even know."
Harper would have replied, but for the moment was swiftly tucking away the last of the biscuit. It had looked big in her palm, but had vanished with disappointing haste.
"Things are going bad here," Renee said.
Harper half thought she was kidding, and was caught off guard by the unease she saw in the other woman's eyes. Renee offered her a tired, crooked smile, and went on.
"You missed a good scene in the school this morning. I give the kids a 20-minute recess after our little history class. They can't go outside, but we block off half the chapel with pews to give them some space to run wild. I noticed Emily Waterman and Janet Cursory whispering together in one corner. Once or twice Ogden Leavitt wandered toward them, and the two girls shooed him away. Well, I brought everyone together after recess for story time, but I could tell Ogden was feeling blue, trying not to cry. He's only 7 and he saw his parents die, killed trying to run from a quarantine patrol. He only recently started talking again. I had him in my lap and I asked him what was wrong, and he said Emily and Janet were superheroes, and he wanted to be a superhero too, but they wouldn't tell him the magic rhyme, and he thought secrets were against the rules. Janet was angry and called him a tattletale, but Emily went pale. I told Ogden I knew a rhyme for superpowers. Bebop-a-lulu, you have superpowers, too. He cheered right up and said now he could fly, and I thought, good job, Renee Gilmanton. You've saved the day again. I tried to steer things back to story time, but then Emily stood up and asked if she could carry a stone in her mouth to make up for keeping secrets. I said that rule was only for serious secrets, grown-up secrets. But Emily looked ill and said if she didn't atone, she wouldn't be able to sing along in chapel. And if you didn't sing and join the bright, you could catch fire. That scared Janet, who started begging for a stone, too. I tried to reassure them. I told them they hadn't done anything they needed to atone for. Harper, they were just being kids. But then Chuck Cargill heard the commotion and wandered over. He's one of Allie's friends, about Allie's age. In the lookouts, of course. And he said it was really cool they wanted to do penance like big kids, and if they each had a stone in their mouths for 10 minutes, it would clean the slate. He got them both stones, and they sucked on them all through story time, looking like Cargill gave each of them a lollipop. You want to know the worst part, Harp? As soon as story time was over, Ogden ran over to Chuck Cargill and announced he had been hiding comic books under his bed and asked if he could do penance, too. By the end of school, half the kids had stones in their mouths. And Harp, they were shining. Their eyes were shining, just like they were all singing together. Oxytocin, Harper muttered. Oxycontin? Isn't that a pain medicine? What? No, nothing. Forget it. You missed morning chapel today, Renee said.
I was rigging up a feeding line for Father Story, she nodded back at the old man. A plastic pouch of apple juice hung from the armature of a floor lamp next to the cot. The tubing did 2 loop-de-loops before disappearing up his nostril. Renee said,
"It's different now, without Father Story."
"Different how?"
"Before, when everyone joined the Bright, it was like, well, everyone compares it to being a little drunk, right? Like having a few swallows of a really good red wine. Now it's like the congregation is throwing down jars of cheap, filthy moonshine. They sing themselves hoarse, and then after they just hum for a while. Stand there swaying and humming, with their eyes burning."
"Humming?" Harper asked.
"Like bees in a hive, or like flies around roadkill." Renee shuddered.
"This happens to you, too?"
"No," Renee said. "I've had trouble joining in. Don Lewiston, too, and a few others. I don't know why."
But Harper thought she did. When she had first read Harold Cross's notes about oxytocin, she had thought randomly of soldiers in the desert and burning crosses in the night. She hadn't seen the connection then, but she did now. Oxytocin was the drug the body used to reward people for winning the approval of their tribe, even if their tribe was the KKK or a squad of Marines humiliating prisoners in Abu Ghraib. If you weren't part of the tribe, you didn't get the payoff. Camp was dividing itself organically, naturally, into those who were in and those who were threats. Renee gazed disconsolately across the room, and in a drifting, absent-minded voice said, "Sometimes I think it would be better if one of these days we just..." Her voice trailed off. "We just..." "What?" Harper asked. "Just helped ourselves to one of the cars and some supplies and took off. Gather up the last few sensible people in camp and run. Ben Patchett has all the car keys hidden somewhere. But we wouldn't have to worry about that. We'd have Gil, and he can..." She caught herself, went silent. "Gil?" "Gilbert. Mr. Klein." Her face was a studied, falsely innocent blank. Harper wasn't fooled for a moment. Something teased her memory, terrible tickling in the mind, and then it came back to her. In the summer, when Renee Gilmanton was a patient at Portsmouth Hospital, she had told Harper about volunteering at the state prison, where she had organized and led a reading group. "Do you two know each other?" Harper asked. But the answer was in Renee's bright, startled eyes. Renee glanced at Nick, who sat now with the empty bowl in his lap, watching them both attentively. "He doesn't read lips," Harper said. "Not really." Renee smiled at Nick and mussed his hair and said, "Glad to see he's recovering from that stomach ache." She lifted her chin, met Harper's stare, and said, "Yes, I knew him straight away, the moment I saw him. Well, New Hampshire is a small state. It would be a shock if some of us didn't know each other from our former lives. He was part of the book club I led up in Concord. I'm sure most of the men there joined the reading group just for a chance to talk to a woman. Standards drop after you've been locked up a while, and even someone almost 50 and built like Mr. Potato Head starts to look good." "Oh, Renee." Renee laughed and added, "But Gil cared about the stories. I know he did. He made me nervous at first, because he kept a notebook and wrote down everything I said, but eventually we got comfortable with each other." "What do you mean, comfortable? Did you have him sitting in your lap for story time?"
"Don't be awful," Renee cried,
with a look on her face that suggested such an awfulness was, in fact, delightful.
"It was literary talk, not pillow talk. He was hard to draw out, shy, you know. But I thought he had fine insights and told him so. I had encouraged him to seek a degree in English from UNH. I believe he had just enrolled in an online course when the first cases of dragon scale began to appear in New England."
Renee looked down at her boots and said, in an offhand tone,
"We appear to be reconvening the book club, as a matter of fact. I have Ben's permission to visit the prisoners. He even let me set up a corner of the basement with some ratty chairs and a scrap of carpet. Once a night, the prisoners are allowed out of that awful meat locker to have a cup of tea and sit down with me. Under guard, of course. Although whoever is watching us usually sits on the basement stairs to give us some privacy. We're reading Watership Down together. Initially, Mr. Mazzucchelli was opposed to reading a story about rabbits, but I think I brought him around. And Gil, Mr. Klein, well, I think he's just glad to have someone to talk to."
Renee hesitated, then added,
"I'm glad to have someone to talk to, too."
"Good," Harper said.
"I understand Gil has a quote by Graham Greene on his chest," Renee said.
She was studying a bit of wet snow as it slid off the tip of one boot. Her voice was calculatedly indifferent.
"Something about the nature of imprisonment, but of course I've never seen it."
"Ah," Harper said. "Nice. If Ben comes in on the two of you and you've got Gil half out of his clothes, tell him it's a matter of urgent literary research, and ask him to come back later, after you're done consulting Gil's Longfellow."
Renee quaked with barely contained mirth. Harper half expected smoke to begin coming out of her ears, and in those days of burning and plague, this was not an entirely unrealistic possibility. It felt good to see Renee laughing over a little innocent filth. It felt like normal life again. Uh-oh, the hens are clucking over something.
Ben Patchett brushed through the curtain into the ward and offered them an uncertain smile.
Should I be worried?
5.
Speak of the devil, Renee said, wiping at her eyes with one thumb.
The hens are clucking. Harper thought it would be a toss-up, which term for women she hated more, bitch or hen. A hen was something you kept in a cage, and her sole worth was in her eggs. A bitch, at least, had teeth. If there was irritation on her face, Ben didn't see it or didn't want to. He paced halfway to Father Story's cot, considering the tube filled with amber-colored juice, the mostly empty plastic bag hanging from the lamp by the bed.
Is that ideal? Ben asked.
Feeding him out of a Ziploc bag? Or the hole in his skull that I sealed with the cork and candle wax?
Totally ideal. Just like they do it at the Mayo Clinic.
Okay, okay. You don't need to snip at me. I'm not snipping at you. I'm a fan, Harper. You've done amazing things here.
He sat on the edge of Father Story's bed, across from her. Springs creaked. He looked at the old man's grave, resting face.
I wish he had told you more about this woman he planned to send into exile.
He didn't say anything except he thought he was going to have to send her away and maybe he'd go with her?
No. He did say one other thing.
What?
He said if he left, he wanted John to be in charge of the camp.
John, the fireman. His voice flat.
Yes.
That's a fascinating piece of information to be hearing at this late date. Why would...
The fireman's not even part of the camp. That's ridiculous. Why not Carol? Why wouldn't he want his own daughter for the job?
Maybe because he knew she was the type of nervous paranoid who would think it's a good idea to hand out rifles to children, Harper said.
Ben glanced quickly at the curtain into the waiting room, as if worried someone might be standing just on the other side, eavesdropping on them.
I'm the one who decided to distribute the firearms, and no one under the age of 16 got one. And I'll tell you something else. I require the lookouts to walk around with the bolt open at all times to prove their rifle is unloaded. I ever see the bolt closed on any of those guns, they'll be sucking on a rock until...
His voice trailed off and he left the sentence unfinished. A rose hue suffused his cheeks.
And you might not want to run around camp calling Carol paranoid. You're in enough trouble as it is. In fact, that's why I'm here. You strayed from camp 2 days ago, went home, and nearly walked right into a cremation crew. Then, after slipping away, thank God, instead of returning to your post, you went across to see the firemen and stayed there most of the night.
My post?
Mother Carol made it clear she expects you to remain by her father's side, night and day, until the crisis passes, one way or another. The immediate crisis did pass, and I have other patients.
Not as far as Mother Carol is concerned.
Ben lowered his head, thought a moment, then looked up. Is that when the fireman plans to make his move? When his busted ribs are healed up?
Make what move? Move where?
Here, to take over.
He doesn't want to take anything over.
It crossed Harper's mind that she might have made a tactical mistake, telling Carol's first lieutenant that Father Story had wanted someone else for Carol's job. Then she thought, fuck it. If the notion of a power struggle with the fireman made Ben squirm, all to the good. Let him feel harassed and threatened for once.
But I suppose he'll do whatever is best for the camp in the end. John always has.
Renee coughed in a way that seemed to mean, shut up. Ben took a moment to compose himself. He laced his fingers together in his lap and looked down into the bowl made of his palms.
Let's go back to when you wandered out of camp. I've been trying to figure out what to do about that.
I think I know how to fix it.
What do you mean, fix it?
There's nothing to fix. I went, I came back, everything is fine, and it's over.
It's not that simple, Harper. We're trying to protect 163 people here.
164, if we count that baby you've got on the way. We have to take steps to keep people safe. If people do things that aren't safe, well, there have to be consequences. If people steal... If they hoard, if they go wandering and potentially get themselves captured by the people who want to kill us.
Harp, I know why you went back. I know you had the best intentions.
But every kid who ever went to Sunday school knows where good intentions get you.
You weren't just risking your life and the life of that precious cargo you're carrying. Harper could not say why the phrase precious cargo made her feel ill. It wasn't the precious part. It was the cargo bit. Possibly it was also an aversion to cliché. When it came to speaking in clichés, Ben Patchett left no stone unturned. But you were also risking Father Story's life and the life of everyone in camp. It was dangerous and thoughtless and violated rules that exist for good reason, and it can't go without consequences. Not even for you. And believe me, there do have to be consequences for unsafe behavior. There has to be a way to keep order. Everyone wants that. They won't stay without. They want to know we're taking steps to keep this shelter safe. People need law. They need to know someone is looking out for them. They may even feel better if they know a few hard-asses are in charge. Strength breeds confidence. Father Story, God bless him. Casting a half-hearted look over his shoulder at the sleepless sleeper behind him, never seemed to understand that. His answer to everything was to hug it out. His reaction to someone stealing was to say possessions are overrated. Things were going to hell even before we brought the convicts back to camp. So, Harper said. He lifted his shoulders and then dropped them in a great sigh. So we at least have to make a show of punishing you, and that's what we're going to do. Carol wants to see you tomorrow to get an update on her father. I'll take you over and we'll stick around, have tea with her. When we come back, I'll pass the word you made amends at the House of the Black Star, that you spent most of the time there with a stone in your mouth. In a lot of ways, that's the fairest way to handle this situation. In my field, we say ignorance of the law is no excuse. Ignorantia juris non excusat, Renee said. But considering punishments in this camp are handed out on the spot, without an opportunity to appeal to an impartial judge or present a fair... Renee, Ben said wearily. Just because you've read a couple of John Grisham novels doesn't make you a Supreme Court justice. I'm giving Harper a way out, so will you lay off my ass? Ben, thank you, Harper said softly. He was silent for a moment, then lifted his gaze and offered her a tentative, wan smile. Don't mention it. If anyone in this camp deserves a little slack, he began. But there's no fucking way, Harper said. He stared at her, his mouth partly open. It took him a while to come up with a response, and when he did, his voice was thin and hoarse. What? No, Harper said. I'm not going to put a stone in my mouth in some moronic, self-abasing act of contrition when I don't have anything to feel contrite about. And I'm also not going to let you lie to people and tell them I went along with this hysterical bullshit either. Will you stop swearing at me? He asked. Why, is swearing against the rules, too? Will it get me another hour with a stone in my mouth? Ben, no. I say no. Absolutely no. I am a fucking nurse, and it is my job to say when something is sick, and this is sick. I'm trying to make things easier here, for cripe's sake. Easier for who? Me? Or you? Or maybe Carol? Is she worried it might undermine her authority if I don't bow and scrape with the rest of you? If I don't play along, maybe other people will make trouble. Is that it? Ben, Renee said, isn't keeping secrets also against one of the rules? You aren't going to get in trouble for plotting to get Harper out of a punishment, are you? I'd hate to see our head of security walking around with a rock in his mouth. That might cost him something in terms of respect. Jesus, he said. Jesus crow. Listen to you two. Harper, they're gonna make you. You can't just... I can't protect you if you won't let me. Your impulse to protect me conflicts with my need to protect my self-respect. Sorry. Besides, I have this vaguely uneasy feeling you're offering to protect me from you. That's not doing me a kindness. That's coercion. He sat there for a time. At last, in a wooden, stilted tone, he said, Carol still needs to see you tomorrow. Good, because I need to see her. Going to my house to get a first aid kit was a decent start to restocking the infirmary, but it isn't nearly enough. And next time I go hunting for supplies, I will need help. Yours, and maybe a few other men. I'm sure Carol will want to weigh in. I appreciate you making the arrangements for my audience with Her Eminence. Ben stood, twisting his wool cap in his hands, muscles bunched and unbunched in his jaw. I tried, he said. He almost tore the curtain down on his way out. 6. From the diary of Harold Cross, July 13th. There was nothing left of Sarah's story but a baked skull and the thigh bones. The deaf-mute was in the cottage with her when the place went up, but he wasn't even singed. He might have been unhurt if the roof hadn't caved in from the heat. I'm monitoring him for signs of internal injuries, but there's not much I can do for him if he's got a ruptured intestine. He'd have to go to Portsmouth Hospital, and that'd be the end for him. Once you go into Portsmouth Hospital, you never come out. No one will say so in Father Story's hearing, but I know a lot of people think Sarah wouldn't have died if she spent more time in camp, singing in chapel with the rest of us. I'm less convinced. I wish I knew more about what she was doing over there with the fireman and her little boy. I'm also, frankly, stunned. She contracted dragon scale less than 2 weeks ago. For the longest time, she was the only healthy in camp. I've never heard of anyone burning so quickly after infection. We'll have to sneak back to the cabin soon and get online so I can pass the details of her case on to the right people. The fireman hasn't left the island, not since the accident. The deaf boy is here in the infirmary with me, so I can monitor his condition. And Allie is staying with her aunt and grandfather. She drifts around looking like she's dosed up on a heavy narcotic. She's the zombie version of herself, pasty and dead-eyed. Is it wrong to be thinking about how grief is a famous aphrodisiac? If she's looking for comfort, Mr. Harold Cross's shoulder is a fine place for her to shed her tears. Oh, I am a bad, bad, bad man. A thought inspired by Phileo's story. Sarah's story has turned to ash, and her ash contains the active spore, waiting for a new host, which means the spore is prepared for reproduction by heat, but not destroyed by it. An enzyme must protect it from damage. Enough of that enzyme could, theoretically, also coat the skin and act as a fire retardant. So, my theory? The fireman can trick the enzyme into protecting the host. Sarah's story couldn't and is now flambé. But what is the enzyme trigger? Something else to discuss with the guys online. Nick's story isn't a complete mute. Right now he's groaning like he can't take a turd. FML, I'm never going to get to sleep. 7. Harper woke with a jolt, as if her bed were a boat that had struck a rock, the hull grinding off stone. She blinked into the darkness, not sure if a minute had passed or a day. The boat shivered off the rocks again. Ben stood at the foot of it, nudging the bed frame with his knee. She had slept from dawn to dusk, and another evening had come. "Nurse," Ben said. Only it was not the same Ben who had pleaded with her the night before. This was Officer Patchett, his soft, pleasant, round face gone blank and formal. He was even in his police uniform, dark blue trousers, pressed blue shirt, dark blue coat with a white fleece lining, and the words Portsmouth PD printed on the back in bold yellow letters. "Yes?" "Mother Carol is hoping for an update on Father's story," Ben told her. "As soon as you're ready, Jamie and I will walk over with you." Jamie Close stood in the doorway to the waiting room, passing a white rock from hand to hand. "Before I update her on the patient's progress, I'd like to update myself and take a minute to get ready. If you'll wait in the other room?" Ben nodded and cast a casual look toward Nick, who was sitting up in bed, watching with wide, fascinated eyes. Ben threw him a wink, but Nick did not smile. The police officer ducked through the curtain, but Jamie Close lingered. "You like dishing out the medicine," Jamie said. "We'll see how you like taking it." Harper was trying to think of a brave, clever reply when Jamie followed her superior back into the waiting room. Nick signed, "Don't go." "Have to," she said with her hands. "Don't," Nick told her silently. "They're going to do something bad." She grabbed the pad of paper and wrote, Don't get yourself worked up. You might give yourself a stomach ache.
Harper was combing out her hair in the bathroom when there was a little knock.
Yes, come in.
Michael nudged the door inward 3 inches. His freckled boyish face was very pale behind his coppery twist of a beard.
Insulin shot?
Go ahead, I'm dressed. He removed the lid on the back of the toilet and fished out a plastic bag with a few disposable sticks of insulin left in it. It wasn't the most hygienic place to store medical supplies, but it kept them cold. He lifted his shirt to reveal a bony edge of fish belly white hip bone and dabbed at it with an antiseptic wipe.
Ma'am, he said, not looking at her. You need to be careful tonight.
People ain't right. They aren't thinking right. Allie isn't thinking right.
Will you be here keeping an eye on the infirmary while I'm visiting with Carol? Harper asked.
Yes, ma'am.
Good. Nick will be glad to have a pal around.
Ma'am, do you hear what I'm saying? About people not thinking right? I tried to talk to Allie at breakfast. I don't know what's come over her. She hasn't eaten in days, and she wasn't in any shape to be missing meals to begin with. Someone's got to do something. I'm scared.
Michael Lindquist.
She can take that stone out of her mouth and have breakfast any time she likes.
I'm sorry if you want me to give her an easy out, but I am not going to encourage more of this barbaric nonsense by going along with it.
If you came in here to see if you could bully me or guilt me...
No, ma'am, no, he cried with real anguish.
That's not what I'm trying to do at all. You're not doing anything wrong. That's not what's worrying me. What's worrying me is the way Carol and Ben and all Allie's friends are cheering her on while she starves herself. You're in the infirmary all day and all night, so you don't see that part. You don't see the neighbor sisters whispering to her that she can't give in, that the whole camp believes in her. Or the way all her friends sit with her after she's missed another meal and chant her name until her eyes start glowing and she's in the bright. It's almost like she needs them to be proud of her more than she needs to eat. And none of them care how thin she is or how fragile she's getting. I'm scared she's going to go hypoglycemic and crash, pass out and maybe swallow that stone. Christ, it's enough. It's enough to make a person think about just grabbing her and, you know, throwing some stuff in a suitcase.
He was the second person in 24 hours to admit he had given thought to scarpering off.
Harper wondered how many others were about sung out, and if Carol knew how dangerously slippery her grip on the camp really was.
Maybe she did. Maybe that explained everything.
Michael swallowed heavily. In a steadier, lower voice, he finished.
You do what you think is right. Just don't get hurt, ma'am.
Allie may hate your guts right now, but she'd hate herself more if you got hurt on her account. He took a shaky breath and then added, I love Carol as much as I ever loved my own mother. You know that? I do. I'd die for her in a heartbeat. His eyes were damp and pleading, and an unspoken but hovered in the air between them. There was more to say, but no time to say it. Ben and Jamie Close were waiting.
8.
Ben led the way. They walked on a bridge of pine planks set end to end across the snow. There seemed to be no light in all the world except for the white disk of Ben's flashlight. Jamie Close followed behind. She had her rifle over her left shoulder and a broom handle in her right hand, cut short, one end wrapped in tape. She whistled while she swung it back and forth. They came out from beneath the firs and proceeded to the house of the Black Star, the cottage where Carol had wintered with her father. It was a tidy one-floor place. Gingerbread shingles and black shutters, named for the enormous iron barn star that hung on its north-facing side between a pair of windows. Harper thought it was a fine bit of decoration, ideal for any inquisitor's dungeon or torturer's crypt. 2 lookouts sat on the single stone step, though they jumped to their feet when Ben came out of the trees. Ben didn't acknowledge them, but only stepped past them and rapped on the door. Carol called them in. Carol sat in an aged mission chair covered in cracked, glossy leather. The chair had surely belonged to her father. It was a place to read Milton, smoke a pipe, and think wise, kindly, Dumbledore-ish thoughts. There was a matching love seat with creamy, pale leather cushions, but no one was seated there. Carol had a pair of lookouts with her, but they sat on the floor, at her feet. One of them was Mindy Skilling, damp-eyed and adoring before Mother Carol. The other was a girlish male, with close-cropped pale hair, feminine lips, and a big knife on his skinny belt. Almost everyone in camp called him Bowie, but Harper wasn't sure if that was because of the knife, or because of his resemblance to Ziggy Stardust. He watched them enter from beneath pink, drooping lids. Harper didn't expect to see Gilbert Klein there, too, but he was seated on the low stone ledge in front of the fire. Red worms twisted in the heaped coals, and the warmth didn't reach far. Frost had turned the panes of glass to brilliant squares of diamond, and made Harper feel as if she had entered a cave behind a frozen waterfall. Jamie Close banged the door shut and leaned against it. Ben heaved himself down on the love seat with a great sigh, as if he had just come in from hauling armfuls of wood. He patted the space beside him, but Harper pretended not to see. She didn't want to sit with him, and she didn't care to appear as a supplicant at Carol's feet. She remained close to the wall, her back to a window, winter breathing on the nape of her neck. Carol's gaze drifted to Harper. Her eyes were glassy and feverish and bloodshot. With her shaved head and starved, wasted face, she had the look of an aged cancer patient, responding poorly to chemotherapy. "It's good to see you, Nurse Willows. I'm grateful you could come by. I know you've been busy. We were just hearing from Mr. Klein about how he came to be hiding by South Mill Pond, not 100 yards from the police department. Some tea? Some breakfast?" "Yes, thank you." Mindy Skilling rose without being spoken to and padded away into the darkened kitchenette. "It seems Mr. Klein couldn't plausibly have had anything to do with what happened to my father," Carol went on. "And I've been interested to know something about who my dad risked his life for. Maybe gave his life for. You don't mind, do you, Nurse Willows? He was just starting to tell us the story of his escape." "No, I don't mind," Harper said. Mindy was already back, handing her a little china cup of hot tea and a plate with a thin slice of fragrant nutty coffee cake on it. Harper's stomach rumbled noisily. Coffee cake? It seemed only slightly less luxurious than a foaming hot tub. "Go on. Please continue, Mr. Klein. You were saying where you and Mr. Mazzucchelli met." "This was in Brentwood, at the county lockup." Klein gave Harper a lingering, curious look. "What are you here for?" Before turning to face Carol. "They've got a facility there to hold maybe 40 prisoners, and they had 100 of us there. There were 10 cells, each about 10 feet long, with 10 men packed in each. They put a TV in a hall and played Bedknobs and Broomsticks and Pete's Dragon so we'd have something to watch. All they had was kid videos they keep around for family visits. There was one guy who lost his mind down the hall. Sometimes he'd start screaming, 'I'll be your candle on the water,' until guys started hitting him to shut him up. After a while, I started to think they were running those two videos to torture us." It jarred her to hear about someone trapped and going mad with panic while singing that particular song. Gilbert Klein was, in some ways, describing Harper herself when she got stuck in the storm drain. "None of us were supposed to be down there longer than a few days. There's only a couple of reasons you wind up in Brentwood. Most of the men there were awaiting trial. In my case, I was down from the prison in Concord to provide testimony in an ongoing case, not my own. The Maz had been brought in from the state prison in Berlin to appeal his conviction."
"What was he in jail for?" Carol asked.
"He looks like a rough customer," Gil said. "But they locked him up for perjury. I can't tell you whether he hurt your father or not, ma'am. But the Maz isn't the sort of guy who buys himself trouble with his hands. His mouth has always been his problem. Can't help himself. He doesn't know how to tell a story without smearing a thick layer of bullshit on top."
"One more reason to hear about your escape from Brentwood from you instead of him," Carol said.
"And you can spare us the potty mouth while you're at it, mister," Ben said. "There's ladies present."
Harper almost choked on her last mouthful of coffee cake. She could not have explained to anyone quite why the phrase potty mouth bothered her more than the word bullshit.
She cleared her throat and morosely considered her empty saucer. She had meant to eat her slice of cake slowly, but there was only a little bit of it, and after the first soft, dissolving mouthful of sugar and nutmeg, she hadn't been able to help herself. Now it was horribly, tragically, impossibly all gone. She put the saucer on an end table so she wouldn't be tempted to lick it. Gil continued.
I was only supposed to be in Brentwood until I testified, but they shut the court down. I waited for them to pack us up and send us back, but they never did. They just kept shoveling in more prisoners. A young man in my cell once approached the bars to say he wanted to lodge a complaint and meet with his lawyer. A state trooper walked over and popped him right in the mouth with his nightstick, knocked in 3 teeth with one slug. Your complaint has been noted. Speak right up if there's anything else bothering you, this cop said, and then gave us all a look to see if anyone else was dissatisfied with their treatment. That didn't happen, Ben said. In my 20 years of police work, I've heard 1,000 reports of police brutality, and only about 3 I thought held water. The rest was just sorry drug addicts, drunks, and thieves, looking to get even with the person who locked them up. It happened all right, Gilbert said in a calm, untroubled tone. Things are different now. Law ain't law anymore. Without someone higher to answer to, the law is just whoever's holding the nightstick. A nightstick or a dish towel full of rocks. Ben bristled. His chest swelled, threatening to pop a button. Carol held up one hand, palm outward, and Ben closed his mouth without speaking. Let him continue. I want to hear this. I want to know who we brought to our camp, what they've seen, what they've done, and what they've been through. Go on, Mr. Klein. Gil lowered his gaze, like a man trying to remember some lines of verse from a poem he had memorized years before, for a long-ago English class, perhaps. At last, he looked back up, meeting Carol's stare without fear, and he told them how it had been. 9. They weren't all bad cops in Brentwood. I don't want to give that idea. There were folks who made sure we had food and drink and toilet paper and other necessities. But the longer we were in there, the harder it was to find a friendly face. There were a lot of angry cops who didn't want to be looking after us. And when people started to get the scale, they weren't just angry. They were scared, too. Anyone could see what was going to happen, the way we were all crowded in together. One morning, a guy came down with dragon scale in a cell at the end of the block. The other prisoners panicked. I understand why they did what they did. I like to think I wouldn't have gone along with them, but it is hard to say. His cellmates forced the infected boy into a corner, not touching him, just driving him back with pillows and such. Then they clubbed him to death. Jesus, Ben whispered. He didn't die easy, either. They were banging his head off the walls and the floor and the side of the toilet for 20 minutes, all while this one lunatic in another cell sang Candle on the Water and laughed about it. Eventually, the infected prisoner began to smolder and char. He never completely caught fire, but he made plenty of smoke before he died. It was like being in an Indian sweat lodge. Men were crying from all the smoke and coughing on the ash. Well, after they beat this poor kid to death, the Stadies dragged the corpse out of the cell with rubber gloves and disposed of him. But we all knew it was going to spread. The whole place was a concrete petri dish. Pretty soon it was on a couple of guys in a completely different cell. Then it was on 3 boys in another unit. I have no idea how or why it could hop around like that. Harper could have told him, but it was no matter now. The firemen had said the world was divided into the healthy and the sick, but soon it would be down to the sick and the dead. For everyone in the room, the subject of how dragon scale spread was now of academic interest only. The state cops didn't know what to do. There wasn't a facility for dealing with felons coated with dragon scale, and they didn't want to release any of the prisoners into the civilian population. The cops got dressed in riot gear and rubber gloves and herded all the men who had dragon scale into one cell, all together, while they tried to figure out what to do. Then, one morning, this guy starts screaming, I'm hot! I think I'm dying!
I got fire ants crawling all over me. Then he was screaming smoke. It was coming out of his throat before the rest of him started to burn.